How could he allow himself to become the cheerleader of the porn star presidency?
Even if you rarely read biographies, I would suggest reading this one.
My mother thought she'd make a man of me, so she made me have boxing lessons, and I had to go and do physical training and all sorts of things like that. But of course it never made any difference in the end.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Kenya's top court affirms a queer rights group's right to exist. Indiana's gay married Mayor Pete qualifies for Democratic presidential debates. And a South African-born Australian 90-year-old recalls 30 years of LGBTQ activism. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending March 23rd, 2019. Kenya's Court of Appeal in Nairobi has affirmed a high court ruling that the coordinating board must register the National Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission as a non-governmental organization or NGO. The board must approve the registration of every NGO to legally operate in the East African country. It rejected the group in 2015 because its members' sexual activities are criminal under Kenyan law, and therefore allowing gay and lesbian in its name was unacceptable. The Court of Appeal ruled 3-2 on March 22nd that LGBTQ people have the right to form an organization for mutual support. As Justice Philip Waukee told the court, the reality is that this group does exist, and we can no longer deny that. The two dissenting justices worried that allowing the LGBTQ group to register would contribute to the destruction of Kenyan cultural values. A tweet by the National Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission celebrated what it called the big win for freedom of association and a vibrant civil space. The group's news release said that the ruling supports inclusivity and sets a positive precedent for other rights organizations in Kenya and across Africa. The penal code Kenya inherited from its British colonizers punishes sex acts against the order of nature with up to 14 years in prison. Another ruling by the High Court due on May 24th could strike down those laws.
A bill to amend the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act to specify that it can't be used to justify discrimination has been reintroduced in the U.S. Congress. Democratic Representatives Joseph P. Kennedy III of Massachusetts and Bobby Scott of Virginia, along with Senator Kamala Harris of California, are leading the move. The amendment was first proposed in 2017 following the U.S. Supreme Court Hobby Lobby ruling, the decision that private companies, under the Act, could deny certain types of contraception, otherwise covered by its employees' health care plans, based on an employer's religious beliefs. Amending the legislation would ensure access to that coverage. It's believed that it would also help protect LGBTQ people from faith-based bias. The Do No Harm Act would clarify that no one can seek religious exemption from laws guaranteeing fundamental civil and legal rights. It has the support of virtually every major U.S. LGBTQ advocacy group and several civil rights and faith organizations, including the ACLU and Americans United for Separation of Church and State.
Meanwhile, the Equality Act has been reintroduced in the U.S. Senate by Democrat Jeff Merkley of Oregon. It would amend the Civil Rights Act of 1964 to prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity in employment, housing, and public accommodations. The measure was proposed in years gone by as the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, or ENDA. It has a modicum of bipartisan support this time. Maine Republican Susan Collins is a co-sponsor in the Senate. Pennsylvania Republican Representative Brian Fitzpatrick and New York Democratic Representative John Katko are co-sponsors in the House. Openly gay Rhode Island Democrat David Cicilline is spearheading the legislation in the House with the strong backing of Speaker Nancy Pelosi. While chances of passage of both the Religious Freedom Restoration Act Amendment and the Equality Act in the Democratic Majority House are good, it remains to be seen how much support they'll have in the Republican-controlled Senate. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has never met a queer-positive bill he liked.
According to a study released this week by the Public Religion Research Institute, majorities of people in all 50 states support non-discrimination protections for LGBTQ people, and that includes a majority of Republicans and majorities in all major religious groups. The far right, however, is freaking out. Matt Staver of the rapidly homophobic Liberty Council warns that the Equality Act threatens the free exercise of religion and free speech. Far-right pundit Glenn Beck told Fox News Trump cheerleader Sean Hannity that if Donald Trump is not reelected in 2020, it will signal the end of the country as we know it. Kristen Wagoner of the Alliance Defending Freedom claims that the legislation would undermine women's equality and force Americans to participate in events and speak messages that violate their core beliefs. Televangelist Pat Robertson hinted at the apocalypse. They want men to go into women's bathrooms and women's locker rooms. The whole thing is chaotic, he charged, adding that the Bible says when there is no vision of God, the people perish, and we have gone to the point where God will give us up.
We reported during our last newscast about the Pentagon issuing a directive on March 12th to begin implementing Donald Trump's proposed ban on transgender people serving the U.S. Armed Forces. But one federal judge has said, not so fast. This Way Out's Lucia Chappell explains.
The Trump administration was wrong last week when it claimed that it could begin to implement the president's proposed ban on transgender people serving in the U.S. military. This according to a judge in U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C. Judge Colin Colicatelli said in a notice on March 19th that defendants were incorrect in claiming there was no longer an impediment to the military's implementation of the transgender policy and that defendants remain bound by this court's preliminary injunction to maintain the status quo. A three-judge appeals court panel overturned her injunction in January, but the panel has not issued its final order. Because there is no final order, the plaintiffs have not been able to file a formal appeal of that ruling to the full court. Colicatelli based her contention that her injunction still stands on those issues. BuzzFeed reports that the plaintiffs have until March 29th to request a hearing before the full bench of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. If their appeal is accepted, it could further delay the implementation of Trump's purge of transgender troops. The White House has yet to respond to the ruling. I'm Lucia Chappell.
In other news, Puerto Rico Governor Ricardo Rosselló announced this week that he will sign an executive order banning so-called gay conversion therapy for minors. According to Pink News, he's going against the members of his own New Progressive Party, which blocked legislation to ban conversion therapy in the House of Representatives. I strive for Puerto Rico to be a society in which everyone, no matter who they love, can be accepted and live without fear of persecution, Rosselló said. This includes the most vulnerable in society, our children, who must be supported and loved. Conversion therapy, the governor added, does not benefit anyone in any way. It only causes unimaginable pain and suffering.
Costa Rica's Supreme Court has ordered the government to open civil marriage to same-gender couples before May 2020, when it will automatically come into force. The ruling said that it was unconstitutional for the Family Code to discriminate against queer couples. President Carlos Alvarado told the Associated Press this week that lawmakers will get it done. But Gay Star News reports there are 57 seats in the legislative chamber, and 14 of them are held by evangelical anti-LGBTQ members. Costa Rica's first openly gay lawmaker, Enrique Sanchez, has accused the chamber of intentionally delaying what his country's Supreme Court has made inevitable. As a signatory to the American Convention on Human Rights, Costa Rica is also bound by a January 2018 order of the Inter-American Court of Human Rights requiring all countries in the region without marriage equality, and that's still most of them, including Costa Rica, to allow gay and lesbian couples to legally marry.
And finally, the Chick-fil-A fast food restaurant chain is still anti-queer. That's the conclusion of the City Council in San Antonio, Texas. They voted 6-4 this week, with one abstention, to deny the outlet a concession space at the San Antonio International Airport. It was apparently no accident that the council vote came on the heels of a report by Think Progress that the company's tax filings show that it's still making substantial donations to anti-queer organizations and causes, $1.8 million in 2017 alone, despite public pronouncements to the contrary. One of the organizations the company funds is the Paul Anderson Youth Home, a Christian residential home for troubled youth, according to its website. It teaches that same-gender love is a sin, and that marriage equality rages against Jesus Christ and his values. Another one of Chick-fil-A's birds of a feather is the Salvation Army, which itself has a long and troubled anti-queer track record. Chick-fil-A CEO Dan Cathy has claimed that those who support marriage equality shake their fists at God, and has said his company operates on biblical principles. San Antonio City Councilman Roberto C. Trevino told Out in San Antonio that the vote to deny space to the anti-queer company affirmed the work our city has done to become a champion of equality and inclusion. Everyone should feel welcome, he added, when they walk through our airport. A press release from Chick-fil-A clocked that the vote was disappointing.
That's News Wrap, Global Queer News with Attitude for the week ending March 23rd, 2019. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at the ever-updating thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
Does Pete Buttigieg actually have a shot at the Democratic Party's nomination for President of the United States? It may be a long shot, but the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, has now met the donor goal to be invited to participate in the party's first nationally televised debate. Being openly gay and married is not the only thing that's helped Buttigieg gain attention in the crowded fields of hopefuls. He's a Rhodes Scholar and Afghanistan war vet who has a winning way with an audience. He speaks 8 languages, a skill that made a big splash on Twitter last week when he responded to a journalist in her native Norwegian. He's also got special insight into one of the people he'd be up against if he eventually makes it onto the Democratic ticket. At a candidate town hall at the South by Southwest Conference in Austin, Texas, CNN's Jake Tapper asked Buttigieg to assess a fellow Indianan.
Do you think Vice President Pence would be a better or worse president than President Trump?
Oh. Does it have to be between
politics is about choices, man. You know that.
I mean, I don't know. It's really strange because I used to at least believe that he believed in our. I've disagreed with him ferociously on these things, but I thought, well, at least he believes in our institutions and he's not personally corrupt. But then how could he get on board with this presidency? How could somebody who, you know, his interpretation of Scripture is pretty different from mine to begin with. Okay, my understanding of Scripture is that it is about protecting the stranger and the prisoner and the poor person and that idea of welcome. That's what I get in the gospel when I'm in church. And his has a lot more to do with sexuality and, I don't know, a certain view of rectitude. But even if you buy into that, how could he allow himself to become the cheerleader of the porn star presidency? Is it that he stopped believing in Scripture when he started believing in Donald Trump? I don't know.
For a review of recent programming and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show, log on to thiswayout.org.
I knew the word homosexuality, but everybody thought I was just a sissy anyway, which I probably was.
Becoming Manny DeSax. later in the program. Premier Harlem Renaissance intellectual Elaine Locke has fascinated This Way Out's queer life and literature commentator Janet Mason for a long time, so she was anxious to delve into the definitive Oxford University Press biography by Jeffrey C. Stewart.
I have long been fascinated by the figure of Elaine Locke, who I knew as the first African-American Rhodes Scholar in 1907, the philosopher that the civil rights leader Martin Luther King spoke about, the influential Howard University professor, the historically black university located in Washington, D.C., and perhaps most importantly to me, as the philosophic architect of the Harlem Renaissance. Locke was known for the fact that he championed such writers as Zora Neale Hurston. That I heard he was gay only made him more interesting. Then I learned that the long-awaited biography of Locke was coming out, written by Jeffrey C. Stewart, titled The New Negro, The Life of Elaine Locke. It was published in 2018 by Oxford University Press and received the 2018 National Book Award for Nonfiction. Then the book arrived. I have to admit that I was daunted by its 800 pages, 878 to be exact. Also, like many people, if not most, I rarely read biographies. But once I started reading this one, I found it so fascinating that I could barely put it down, even though it is physically hard to pick up because it is so heavy. Locke, as Stewart writes, was a tiny, effeminate gay man, a dandy, really. Often seen walking with a cane, discreet, of course, but with just enough hint of a swagger to announce to those curious that he was queer in more ways than one. Some of the intriguing things I learned was that Locke was very close to his mother. In fact, after her death in 1922, left him bereft, and after a stint of traveling in Europe, where he could be more sexually open, and after being fired for a time by Howard University for being too vocal on race relations, although he was later hired back, he poured himself into their shared love for art and commenced on starting the Harlem Renaissance, with the idea that there was liberation in art that was African-American identified. The Harlem Renaissance loomed so large in my mind that even though I already knew that it was basically over by 1929, when the American stock market collapsed, it was rather depressing to read about it again. Harlem, along the African-American section of New York City, was hit very hard by the Great Depression. The Harlem Renaissance, however, remains an important part of history, and many African-American identified visual artists and writers were influenced and inspired by it long after the 1920s, as Stewart writes. I also found it fascinating that the campus of the University of Oxford, where Locke found himself after he won the prestigious Rhodes Scholarship, was a hotbed of gay male activity, and that this was the same university that the gay legend Oscar Wilde was graduated from in 1878. 3 decades before Locke arrived. I also learned that Locke faced less racism in Europe. Most of what I learned was that Locke, a black gay man, faced major obstacles in his life because of racism and homophobia. Despite these obstacles, he thrived, and he changed the course of history. His life is inspiring. Even if you rarely read biographies, I would suggest reading this one, The New Negro, The Life of Elaine Locke. Written by Jeffrey C. Stewart. It's a real page-turner, and you'll learn a lot of important historical information. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin, author of Tales of the City. And you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio news magazine produced by, about, and for our sexually diverse communities and those who love them.
Manny de Sax was in his 60s when he worked up the courage to come out of the closet, and he's been a firebrand of LGBTQ activism in Australia ever since. Now in his 90s, the celebrated South African-born movement veteran and his partner of 30 years live in Melbourne, where This Way Out correspondent Barry McKay paid him a visit. With production assistance from Kathy Sport, listen as Manny recounts some of the highlights of his extraordinary life.
My name is Manny de Sax. I've just turned 90. I am a South African, but I've been living in Sydney and Melbourne for the last nearly 40 years.
When did you first realise that you were gay?
That's a difficult one to answer. I wouldn't have known about gay or anything like that in those days, but I do know that in my school days, particularly high school, sort of after adolescence, I knew that there were some boys that I was very attracted to, but I wouldn't have known beyond that what really the significance of that was.
What was the attitude in your family towards homosexuality?
Well, I don't think it was ever spoken about. I don't know if anybody, any of them, knew anything about it. When I finished at university, I went to work in England for 2 years just after the war, and I came back to South Africa and went to live at home. And at that stage, when I got a job and I was earning my own money, and I very much wanted to go and live on my own in my own flat, my mother wouldn't hear of it.
Did you come from an Orthodox Jewish family?
Well, it was Orthodox to the extent that my grandparents were Orthodox, but by the time of my mother and my stepfather, it wasn't quite so Orthodox anymore. They practiced the Jewish holidays and so on. They kept a kosher home, but it wasn't Orthodox and strict Orthodox in the normal sense.
What was the attitude in the surrounding society towards homosexuality?
There was no information. I didn't really know anything about it. Of course, one sneaked away to look in the dictionary because one knew the word homosexuality. But everybody thought I was just a sissy anyway, which I probably was. And my mother thought she'd make a man of me, so she made me have boxing lessons, and I had to go and do physical training and all sorts of things like that. But of course it never made any difference in the end. When I finished school and went to university, which was 1944, I don't know, I think I started understanding a little bit more, but really knew very, very little. I mean, again, there were lots of students to whom I was attracted physically, but I would never have done anything. I wouldn't have known anything about what to do. And you were supposed to have girlfriends, you know. But it wasn't with girls that I sort of had any feeling whatever.
May I ask when you had your first sexual experience?
One I can't talk about. But after that, I was already married and I think I had children by then. And occasionally, when I had an opportunity to be out of the house on my own, I went like to shopping centres or whatever to see if I could pick up or be picked up by a man. I was always frightened. So, I mean, those were episodes where anything could have happened. And the police in South Africa were not exactly renowned for their gentle behaviour. And my sympathies were with the oppressed people, and I was petrified there of getting involved, because if you went to jail in South Africa as a political activist, there would really be problems. When you went to a beat or something like that, which I did here and there, I was petrified that the cops would come. It was mostly mechanical sex, but here and there I was quite ready to shared affection, but how was I going to do it under the circumstances? It was just very difficult. I was frightened of the people around me, but not at work. I mean, at work it wasn't going to happen. I wasn't going to be outed at work. And then that only started occurring after 1985, when my wife and I separated.
This is Barry McKay, and I'm speaking to South African-born Australian LGBT activist Manny de Sax at his home in Melbourne, Australia.
Why did you decide to come to Australia?
I had a son who was at university and he was getting to be of military age, and if he failed at university, he would have had to go into the South African army, and there was no way that I was going to allow that to happen. And I actually had Australian citizenship. It's a whole long story, but I had Australian citizenship, although I was a South African. So that's how I came to be in Australia. I had been to a political demo and been given a leaflet at the end of it at the Domain in Sydney, which told about a demo outside the British consulate at Circular Quay in Sydney. And I went to my first gay demo in April 1988. And then I discovered that there was a group there who had organized this demonstration, and they were called Gay Solidarity Group. And they invited me to come to a meeting, and that was the beginning of my gay activism. My partner and I, we actually, that's from Gay Solidarity and Lesbian Gay Solidarity, we got together in 1993. And that gave me an awful lot of confidence. It made me realize that I was a person in my own right and made me feel much better as a human being.
So can you introduce your partner?
Oh, well, my partner is Ken Lovett, and he's 94 years old, and we've known each other since 1988, and we've been together since 1993. Ken's situation was better than mine.
How?
He was one of four children. He was the oldest, and he had a fairly satisfactory relation with his parents and his siblings. So his was a more normal existence always. And he didn't go through the convoluted process of having to get married and have a family.
How has Ken been an inspiration to you?
In every single way, with his activism, with his writing, with his affection for me, with everything, in every way you can think of. True, it's true.
If you'd like to see a longer version of this interview on video, please head to the This Way Out webpage at thiswayout.org. This is Barry Mackay in Melbourne, Australia.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Jessica Andrea and Tanya Kane Barry, produced with Brian DeShazer, Janet Mason, and from Barry McKay, with thanks to Kathy Sport. The Rolling Stones performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson, composer, performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, Christopher Matthews, Richard Merck, and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all of the listener donors who make this program possible. You can join them by visiting thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WHAV Haverhill, Massachusetts, to RRR Gladesville, New South Wales, Boise Community Radio, Boise, Idaho, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.